You're listening to a podcast of Spurious Morality.
Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. I'm Johnston and with me this week I have Greg. Or maybe I don't.
Hello everyone, Greg forgot to unmute his mic.
Hey, and I have Jimmy.
Hello.
And we are carrying on with season by season, and we're up to season 21. It's Peter Davison's last season as the Doctor. It's, I think, overall a pretty strong season. I think that if you maybe removed the opening and closing stories from this one, you'd have a contender for perhaps best Doctor Who season ever. But, yeah, Warriors of the Deep and the Twin Dilemma. Maybe we'll find we like them. Maybe it turns out that they're absolutely fantastic, and that's something we're going to discuss. So this is not a conversation I expect either of those two stories to pop up in, but we're going to talk very quickly about what our favourite of the whole season is. So, Greg, do you want to go first?
I mean, it's obviously the Caves of Androzani for a whole litany of reasons, but if I put that one aside, I would say my favourite from having rewatched is probably Frontios, actually.
Yeah, I can see how it's, you do have to put Caves of Androzani to one side, don't you? Because it's just hands down like top tier Doctor Who. What about you, Jimmy?
Yeah, definitely got to go for Caves, but I don't also agree that Frontios is definitely better than I remembered. It had been quite a while since I last saw that before this rewatch, and I mean, it was, other than the Tractator costumes, it was pretty brilliant.
Well, that's three out of three then. Like, it's got to be Caves. That's almost like a contractual obligation of a Doctor Who fan. But if we pretended Caves didn't exist, I'd probably be going for Frontios as well. Maybe a shout for Planet of Fire, but I think Frontios does just pip it a tiny bit. Yeah, it's like I say, I like this season. I think there's some really, really good stuff in here, and I'm looking forward to exploring it properly. So we'll jump straight in and we'll go to Warriors of the Deep, which... I wish it was better. There's an argument with Warriors of the Deep, which is, well, it was made in a hurry, there were strikes, and the Mirker was meant to look better than that. And there seemed to be a pile of excuses as to why this one isn't a solid overall winner. But at the same time, okay, imagine somehow they managed to do the work, the Mirker well. They managed to make it look better, which probably wouldn't be too difficult. How does it become a better story? There's some good ideas in there, and I really like the revisiting Silurians and Sea Devils and bringing them together, and it's kind of just sort of clinging on to that nostalgic run that Season 20 had. In fact, this might be better as a Season 20 story, but it's not. It's a big Base Under Siege story. Like, the entire third episode is just people running away from each other and shooting at each other. The Sea Devils' guns appear to be made out of U-bends. I don't know if anyone else has ever noticed this, but it's not the best looking evil alien weapon in Doctor Who ever. I'm really on the fence as to whether there is a good story in there somewhere and its production let it down, or whether this is just not a fantastic piece of Doctor Who. Like I say, I enjoy that third episode, you know, despite the murker, apart from the murker, take your pick. It's just full of problems, but what it does have is sort of an interesting premise, a good cast, and I kind of wish the world it was set in was explored a little bit more. I think one thing that made Silurians and Sea Devils so effective, and one thing that kind of applies with Hungry Earth as well and a few others, is that they take place relatively contemporary to when the story was made, whereas this sort of actively sets itself in the fairly far future. Was it 100, 200 years off? And it's the world in a couple of hundred years' time, albeit with 1980s global politics still at play. I like what they're doing with that. It is interesting, and as, you know, political ideas, movements do come and go and change, as do situations and allegiances and so on. But I'm just not convinced that it's done as well as it can be. Like, the Silurians and the Sea Devils playing into the Cold War would probably be better if it was actually set during the Cold War. I think it's easier to draw an allegory there. The base is too well lit. This is supposed to be a dank, dingy underwater base, and we can't be bothered working out lighting, or more likely, we haven't got time to work out lighting for this one, boys. Just turn everything up and that'll do. So yeah, I'm very conflicted about Warriors of the Deep, because there's some good ideas in there. I'm not sure those ideas are done as well as they could be. And even to get to that level of analysis, you just have to get past the fact that it looks god awful. It's really shoddy work, unfortunately. It's not a favourite. I wish it was, but it's not. What about you, Greg?
Yeah, I'm even less charitable towards it than you are. I do agree that, like, the concept of it, like the idea, is pretty good. It's an obvious parallel to Cold War politics of 1984, but the idea that, you know, there's two power blocks that are teetering on the edge of war, and then you've got a third party that's trying to provoke them into starting a war with each other, it's reminiscent of the Armageddon factor too, actually, in a way. But I like that idea. You know, we've had spy movies with that sort of theme. We've had Missions Impossible with that sort of theme. You know, a bad guy wants to provoke a war between two superpowers. Okay, fine. And in this case, the bad guy is the Silurians, who are once again trying to reconquer the Earth and wipe out humanity. Okay, fine. And that's all good, and you can make a good story out of that. And I even like some of the little details they've put in, you know, like in order to fire the missiles, like, you have to have someone, like, connected to a machine with, you know, certain mental capabilities. That's interesting too, but none of it comes together at all. And the big reason for that is the production. I mean, this is one of the worst looking Doctor Who stories that's ever been made. I mean, this is worse than most of what we saw in the 60s, when, you know, there was a lot of suspension of disbelief needed to, you know, get past some of the, you know, the alien costumes and so forth. But, like, I mean, I understand the strikes made it hard to do lighting, but just floodlighting everything is terrible. The costumes, like, I mean, the human costumes are fine, whatever, but the Silurians look terrible. The Sea Devils look awful. The Murka is a joke. I mean, it's a pantomime horse. Come on. Like, it's embarrassing. And then even that could possibly be helped a little bit if you have, like, competent directing. But this story does not have that. Like, absolutely no effort is made to, like, conceal how bad things look, There's no attempt at any kind of interesting filming, no attempt really at framing anything, just like broad 2, 3, 4 shots. Like it's an unappealing story that just is so unattractive that it removes any possibility of it being good. Like I know that like Doctor Who famously doesn't have the best production values, but like here it's so bad that I do not think like you could, if you took the Caves of Androzani, the script, and you made it with this production team under these circumstances, it would be garbage. And Warriors of the Deep script is not nearly as good as that. So that gives you an idea what level we're playing on here.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And it, like I said before, I genuinely want to know if there is a good story buried under the atrocious production. But it's the most that'll do Doctor Who ever got. It really feels like they just went, oh, let's just get it made, let's just get it done, who cares? I also don't get how this and Caves of Androzani can be made a couple of months apart from each other. But then again, I don't get how Caves of Androzani and The Twin Dilemma can be made a couple of weeks apart from each other. It's a baffling level of inconsistency. It's absolutely crazy. And it's purely a production thing. Jimmy, what about you?
I think it's obviously not that good, let's be blunt, but I don't think I disliked it quite as much as you two. The production values are definitely the biggest problem, but there is a bit in the script as well that doesn't come across so well. So I don't think even the better production values would have helped if they had happened. First off, the Silurian voices are terrible, and that adding their third eye glows like a Dalek's lights now for speech is just such a silly decision. It's like, what were they thinking? And then plot hole wise, you've got the Doctor leaving the TARDIS door open at one point and so that someone can get in later when he's not there. And it's like, I mean, come on, that's like blatantly done to just hurry the plot along, and why? And writing wise, I think the problem is that it doesn't quite know what to do with the Silurians, because you've literally got one scene where the Doctor is 1 second talking about how the Silurians are honourable and they only want peace, and literally half a minute later he's talking about how, oh, they think humans are an evolutionary error and need to be corrected. And it's like, well, yeah, but you just said they were honourable and only want peace. Like, make up your mind. I think the Sea Devils were slightly better realised than the Silurians. Like, they don't look like they should, but, I mean, other than losing the fins on their head and getting that silly helmet in when they actually get into the base, I think they looked slightly better, and the voices were definitely closer to the originals, and so it just surprised me that they did so much worse with the Silurians themselves. They looked a lot better in the opening scene in the first episode where, in their own base, it's all darkly lit and green, and they look more green and look more like they used to. And yeah, it definitely, they look worse as soon as they're in the overlit base. And also, why do they have turtle shells now? Like, and especially when, like, you could pass it off as, oh, well, this is just, you know, the next generation of Silurians. It's 100 years later, except for the fact that Ikthar is supposed to be the surviving member of the triad from the Silurians, and so why's he got a shell? Also, the Doctor falling into the radiation water meter thing, and just, it's so hilarious when Turlo just sees it, and like, after the Doctor's been underwater for about 5 seconds, he's like, face it, Tegan, he's drowned! And it's just so funny, so ridiculous. And yeah, of course, Merc is terrible, and so is Solo's little silly martial arts moves when she fights it. But yeah, there's lots of weird stuff in this. There's also this weird delivery in the first episode where they're talking about someone who's dead, and they're talking about the sudden demise. And it's like, who pronounces it like that? It's demise. Like, you couldn't even get a retake for that? Like, even in the 60s, they might have done a retake for that. It's, yeah, quite ridiculous. I think the one thing that really works well is the Doctor at the end having there should have been another way, and like If the story had been better realised, it would feel a bit more poignant, but it feels like he's talking about a story. There should have been another way to realise this. God. So, yeah, it's a bit of a disappointment, but I think I do like it still, despite its many, many faults. It's not completely terrible. It's bad, but, I mean, it's season 21. We've got the twin dilemma coming. It's not the worst thing out there.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. Although if the twin dilemma didn't exist, this would easily be the worst story of this season. There's definitely an argument for it being the worst story of Peter Davison's era as well. I mean, I know Time Flight is right there, but it's a name that pops up in the conversation, or certainly should. Interesting that you mentioned the really weird sort of voice treatment on the Silurians. They sound absolutely ridiculous. Considering Peter Halliday's voices for the Silurians in Doctor Who and the Silurians was just fantastic. It's sort of a really good performance. Here it's just like, let's slap an effect on it. Right, that'll do. But one thing that's always stood out to me is one of the sea devils, I think, is called Sauvix, but put through the Silurian voice filter, I genuinely just think it sounds like cervix, which is not the greatest Doctor Who villain name ever. Warriors of the Deep, I think we can all agree, it's not the best Doctor Who ever made. It's a miss, I'm afraid. It's not a hit, it's a miss. Let's move on to The Awakening. Now, I really like The Awakening. It's absolutely bonkers. It has way too many characters for a two-parter. But there's something really charming about it. We meet another member of Tegan's family, and, you know, there's not a single reference to Vanessa. Very extended family like Tegan has. None of them must talk to each other. But that's kind of not really the point. She's popped up to see Grandad. Grandad's disappeared. And now there's a load of weird stuff going on in a village. It's fairly low-key, as quite a few of the two-parters are. And I just think it works really nicely. Like, it's got a good pace about it. It's got some really interesting ideas. I like the malice, you know, both in terms of how it's represented. There's some absolutely fantastic imagery. You know, 1 week later than the Murker, we've got the malice, this gigantic head coming out the wall of a church. And it looks really, really good considering when it was made. Slightly too many characters. There is a scene where they all end up in the TARDIS towards the end, and you just sort of think, this is bonkers. But every character does seem to have something to do, so, you know, I'm all for it. And it's a good guest cast, they're good characters, there's good ideas. There's about three potential new companions in this one. I kind of wonder if at this stage they were sort of aware that obviously Tegan and Turlough were going and they needed to start coming up with characters, perhaps hoping that the same serendipity that happened with Nyssa would occur. You know, maybe Polly James would stay on for a series, or I can never remember the name of the character that gets transported from the past, but he was obviously companion bait as well, I think. It's interesting that we get a lot of companion-like characters in this, and we do in Frontios, and we sort of do in Resurrection of the Daleks, they all die. It's kind of interesting that, I think. The Awakening's a winner. I think it gets lost among sort of the other really good stories in this season. I think that the three, four even, let's not forget Caves Around Azani, the four stories that follow it are probably better than it, but it's probably better than the vast majority of classic Doctor Who. So, yeah, I'm a fan of The Awakening. What about you, Greg?
Yeah, I like it. I wouldn't say I'm as big of a fan as you seem to be, but I think it's a fun, good story. I mean, I think all of the Davison two-parters qualify under that heading in slightly different ways. Like, this is better than The King's Demons, obviously, but like, they're all, you know, a little bit disposable and shorter, of course, and they're just entertaining little Doctor Who stories. And this is the best one of the three. It's it almost, like you said, almost has too much going on. Like, okay, the Malice is, you know, some sort of alien thing that's crashed on Earth, and it's causing this malignant psychic influence on the people in the town and causing them to turn their war game into an actual war. That's neat. It's just, there's, like you said, there's so many characters and there's so much happening that, like, you don't really get a coherent picture of what's going on in the story versus what should otherwise be happening. And that's really my only issue with it, because I like the idea of Tegan, you know, going and visiting family. Like, I like that we see companions having lives outside of the TARDIS, which is a very rare thing in Classic Who. I don't have a lot to say about this one. It's kind of got an android invasion little, you know, paranoid thriller thing going on for parts of it. It's a good story for Tegan. It's a good story for the Doctor. The end doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, and while I think the Malice looks great, like, in just in terms of its appearance, I don't think it's like, it, obviously it's not a dynamic villain and it's pretty clearly just an animatronic face hung on the wall, but yeah, I mean, for what it is and for what it's trying to be, which is nothing groundbreaking, nothing earth-shaking, I think it's a perfectly good story. I agree that, you know, it's ahead of Warriors of the Deep and Twin Dilemma, and it's behind the other four, but I like it. It was fun.
I will add as well that I'm in agreement with you that this is the best of the three Davison two-parters. I think this one does an awful lot more than Black Orchid and King's Demons do for me. It's a good one. Yeah, you mentioned that the end doesn't make an awful lot of sense. At least it ends. Like, Warriors of the Deep didn't end, it just stopped. It was just like, okay, done now, should have been another way, bye. Really abrupt ending.
Everyone was dead, so so much more to do.
Yeah. I can never remember, isn't there at least the character that we don't see die? I'm not saying that somebody that's not the Dr. Tegan Turlough get out of it, but I'm sure in Warriors of the Deep there's somebody that we don't actually see die, and therefore it's comparatively safe to assume that he's still alive. Maybe I'm making that up. I can't remember. The editing of that fourth part is atrocious. Anyway, we're on The Awakening. Jimmy, talk to us about The Awakening.
Yeah, I definitely enjoy this one. I think it's a good, solid story, and it's only two episodes, so it's quick to get through with and pretty enjoyable. But I think the odd thing with it is it's surprisingly dark in a couple of places, which is, of course, first of all, the Doctor's line about the toast of little Hodgkin, which, yeah, okay, sure, that's they're going for the gag, but they even draw attention to Will's sort of reaction to him about, like, she was burning in agony or whatever it was. And it's like, yeah, it's a bit messed up for the Doctor to be joking about that. And then later on, when in the final confrontation scene, Will basically asks in not as many words, do we really need to have Sir George dead? And the Doctor's basically like, yeah, if we need to, sure. And Will kills him. I mean, it's like, it's surprisingly dark. It's really weird to see. I mean, this season does tend to get darker and darker, and of course you get to caves and that, and it's just absolutely doom-laden, but it's just, yeah, really strange to see how dark they get in just an odd little story. The only other thing that really stuck out to me was the Malice. It was, they made such a big point in a few bits of, oh, the church drawings of him they represent him as the devil. They represent him as the devil, but then suddenly at one stage you've got Will saying, he's the god of war. And it just sort of like, okay, I can see the association with war, but like you've been pointing out this devil thing the whole story, and suddenly he's a god. It's just a bit weird, but that's just one little oddity sticking out of an otherwise brilliant story to me. I mean, the rest of it was just really solid. I really enjoyed this one.
I think none of us particularly have an awful lot to say about this one, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. It just gets on with being good Doctor Who, and I'm okay with just gets on with being good Doctor Who. I'm fine with that. Let's go to Frontios then, which is, yeah, I mean, as we all said at the start, if Caves of Androzani didn't exist, this would be our collective favourite. And it's good. It's a really good story. As Jimmy said earlier, like the big, I guess, sort of problem with it would be the Tractators are not the best looking Doctor Who villains ever. Like they don't look great, but there's definitely worse. There's already been worse this season, let's face it. So yeah, take that aside, and we've actually got a really sort of interesting story about essentially a failing society, people that are dying out, and a planet with some incredibly strange properties that involves the actual destruction of the TARDIS. Like, that doesn't come up in best Doctor Who cliffhanger ever conversations, and it really should. Like, we're all busy talking about sort of Caves Part 1 and all that kind of thing, and obviously Death to the Daleks Part 3, when best ever cliffhanger conversations come up, but surely this has got to be there, like just a smouldering lump and a hat stand, and the TARDIS is gone, the TARDIS has been destroyed. Obviously we had a fairly similar thing in The Mind Robber, but I feel as though it hits harder here. Like the Mind Robber's all very weird and surreal, whereas this is very gritty and very real, and there are people dying and an entire society struggling to just stay alive through to the next day. And you've got some very interesting internal bickering and people that will do extreme things. And there's a mystery linked back to the previous generation and all that kind of thing. And as the story goes on, there's some really grim stuff, like the Part 3 cliffhanger, another brilliant one, where we get sort of the captain half dead in a machine, and all this kind of thing. Yeah, it's a grim story. It's a really, really dark story. And you really feel as though the Doctor, Tegan and Turlough are part of that, because they haven't got the option of let's just pop into the TARDIS and go. Like, for a large chunk of the story, you genuinely believe there is no TARDIS left. And I think that's something J&T cottoned onto. Didn't he sort of say something in a press release about destroying the TARDIS or something that around the time, therefore just kind of teasing it a little bit more, I suspect. So yeah, really strong story, really strong set of ideas. It's proper Christopher H. Bidmead, it's 3 out of 3 for him, isn't it? All three of the stories of his in Classic Who are just brilliant, and all three of them are hugely enhanced by a Paddy Kingsland score, which, yet again, this is great. This is probably winner of the season for soundtrack as well. So, yeah, I just love it. I really think this is fantastic. And it's good that Turlough actually gets something to do as well. Sort of in Warriors of the Deep, he's given a gun and said, you know, point it that way, and that's basically his role in the whole story. Apart from that fantastic face he's drowned line, Awakening, he spends a good chunk of locked up, if I remember correctly. In this, you've got the whole race memory thing, and a lot of stuff comes from Turlough and is focused on Turlough, and I like how that works. So yeah, this is a good story. Your go, Greg, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, just picking up right from there, I do agree that Turlough is very underserved through most of his tenure. It's after Enlightenment, they pretty much had no idea what to do with him. And this is the first story in which someone actually gives him like an integral part in the proceedings. And it's no coincidence that that's Bidmead writing it. This is someone who like really understands like how these characters work. You know, this is someone who, you know, in writing Legopolis managed to, you know, juggle the huge TARDIS team and give them all like something to do. Same with Castrovalva. And he's, you know, with one fewer companion here, he's doing the same thing. It demonstrates his just very deep understanding of who the Fifth Doctor is and how he works. I know Peter Davison has said that this is his favorite story, or at least his favorite portrayal of the Doctor. He said this was like the first time that the script actually lined up with how he wanted to play the character. And that's really evident. I mean, the Doctor switches here. Like on one hand, he's very like professorial. Like he's like very much taking an interest in the knowledge and education of his companions and the people around him. On the other hand, he is a grumpy jerk at times, who is very sarcastic and it's just great. And you can see Davison just having a blast, like playing this just sardonic, quick-witted character that often we don't see as much of in his other stories. And so that's great. I think the setting is great. Like season 21 has a very dark and gritty and downbeat feel to it. What I like about this story is that the setting and the surroundings are certainly dark and downbeat, but unlike Eric Sayward, and I'll talk about this more in the resurrection discussion, but you know, Sayward was trying to use this season to show the Doctor as a useless, you know, helpless, ineffectual kind of hero, whereas Bidmead just ignores that completely and has the Doctor be like the center of attention here and successfully save the day. And while I admire Sayward for trying to do something different with the character, it just never feels, you know, that vision of the universe for me isn't so compatible with what we know of Doctor Who, and it's not a coincidence that, you know, no one else ever tried to go to that well. And I like seeing stories like this where, you know, the Fifth Doctor can be hero. Yeah, the tractators don't look good. Honestly, I think they're not bad. It's mostly just the Gravis, like, being the same as the other ones and just kind of, like, bouncing up and down when he talks. That looks bad, but the other ones are fine, whatever. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, knock a story down just because the monsters don't look super convincing. But, yeah, I mean, it's a really good story. It's got a great cast. It's got stuff for all the leads to do. It's got good supporting characters. Like Plantagenet is it actually an interesting character, which is unique. Like you assume from minute one that he's just this, you know, he's the unqualified child of the previous leader taking over, and he's covering up for his stupidity by being a, you know, a dictator. But as you go through the story, you realize that like it's more that he's, you know, scared of his role and he's putting on a front and he's actually deeply concerned for his people, which usually classic Doctor Who villains don't show that level of, you know, those sorts of layers. So I like that. I mean, I think it's a, you know, it's a good story all the way around. And I like the ending too, where it's like the tractators are harmless without the Gravis. So we'll just take that to another planet. And yeah, as, you know, as long as there's something for him to eat there, I think that's a great solution. So yeah, no, this is an excellent story. And if it wasn't, you know, for one of the greatest stories of any era of Doctor Who coming up later, this would easily be the best of this season.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you were saying about Davison's performance. Like this is the proper Fifth Doctor. This is the one he wanted to be. This is the one that creeps out at Big Finish every now and again, and this is the one where he puts the glasses on, isn't it, sort of, that was referenced in Time Crash and all that kind of thing. this is peak Davison, and this is how Davison's Doctor should have been written all along. And we kind of get glimpses of this Doctor again in, well, in his last few stories now, but it's the Fifth Doctor as he should be is most prominent here. And I think that actually is one of the things that elevates this one. Jimmy, talk to us about Frontios.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one. I agree with pretty much most of what you both said. I mean, it's a really great story, really brilliant dark atmosphere, great guest cast. And yeah, some of the writing is really good too. Like, I love how the Doctor's all hesitant about not wanting to land, and we can't interfere, we're not supposed to be here, but he immediately turns on a dime and starts helping everyone straight away and just like, don't tell anyone. It's, yeah, it's so good seeing him like that. It's really brilliant characterization, and as you say, it's what Davison wanted the role to be, and I think they realized it really well. And also, Turlough is on great form. I love that they delved into his history and his planet's history by having him get that sort of race memory thing of the Tractators, and brilliant performance. Turlough just looks absolutely completely out of it. It's just really, really well done. And I also love earlier in the story how much pleasure he takes in that first episode about telling Tegan about the doomed humanity and its last survivors and so on. It's just, it's great to see him being like a bit of an arsehole, let's be honest. It's, yeah, really good stuff. And yeah, as I was saying about the dialogues, like the Doctor's blunt assessment at one stage of how little chance the colony has, and that brilliant scene where they're like, failure-proof technology, what happened? It failed. Just like, it's simple, but it's brilliant. I mean, really, the Tractator costumes are pretty much the only fault with this story. I think the only other thing that I'd even count as a fault is I do think it looked a bit silly when the TARDIS has supposedly been exploded to have just the hat stand survive. I mean, it's like, come on, you could have scattered out. I mean, there's not much in the console room. It's not like the 60s, but they should have had something else, because when it's just the hat stand, it looks a bit like, okay, how? Why? Like, I mean, it's a silly nitpick, but it's like it just comes across really weird. But on the other hand, I love the realization when you get underground of the sort of half cave, half TARDIS blend. It looked really good. And for like, that's the thing with this story. Everything except the Tractator costumes was really realized well. Like, it does feel like a dying planet on its last legs, a colony that's failing. These underground scenes, and it's, yeah, I just think they've realized everything in this story except the Tractator costumes well. And it's such a pity that that has to be that one thing that stops it from being basically perfect. Oh, no, there is one more thing that was a bit weird. At the end, in that final episode or confrontation with the Doctor and the Gravis, the Gravis is like, oh, yes, of course we've heard of you, Doctor. Oh, yes, of course we've heard of Gallifrey. What? You have a TARDIS? And it's like, how do you hear about the Doctor, hear about Gallifrey, know what a TARDIS is, and yet not know the Doctor has one? Like, that is some bad writing. Like, I'm sorry, the rest of the story was brilliantly well written, but that was just confusing and weird. And, like, if they, I don't know how they got that through. It was just really odd. But I did love the Doctor's bit with Tegan when he's pretending she's an android and he's taking the piss out of her accent, and the death glare that Janet Fielding is giving him is just amazing. Love that moment. So, yeah, overall, brilliant, but, yeah, not faultless, but still, yeah, definitely, if it weren't for Caves, the best by a long way of the season. Really great stuff.
Yeah, I agree that it's daft that the hat stand is the only thing that remains, but I also love the point that it's a plot point. Like, it is used to further the story. And that, like, that hat stand has been around, what, more or less since the start, I think, hasn't it? I don't know when it first appeared. I'm fairly sure somebody's going to be able to tell me that when it first popped up. But as far as I'm aware, that hat stand has been about in some form or another since pretty much the beginning. And it's kind of cool to actually have it fulfill a role beyond hat stand. Yeah, I quite like it. Although now you mention it, it is daft that that is the representation of everything in the TARDIS when the TARDIS is destroyed. Yeah, total winner for Antios, big fan of it. And while I'm in agreement that they're not the best costumes ever, as I've said, we've already sort of had worse this season. And also, they do genuinely blend into the sort of set wall that's meant to be rock. There's a bit where there's an entire scene goes on, characters kind of trot off out of the shot, and then the two of them just turn around and Tractators have been there all along. I actually really, really like that. It does look good. But then again, saying your costume looks like a piece of 1980s set may not be the best compliment. Let's do Daleks then. We've not seen Daleks for a while. Season 17, season by season, feels like absolutely ages ago. And it's probably is the biggest gap in Classic Who without Daleks, isn't it? I suppose you've got 6 to 9. But yeah, this is the biggest gap without Daleks. We're not counting the Five Doctors, because that was just a little cameo. And this is good. It's a good story. It's a solid story. It's a grim story. Eric Saywood's definitely in like full misery bloodbath mode in this one, and it doesn't let up at all. The first episode has a massacre, the second episode has a massacre, and if you split it into all four, like a four-parter, parts 3 and 4 have a massacre. There's a discussion to have. Like, when you guys go on, just tell us, do you consider this to be a two-parter or a four-parter? Because I saw this as a four-parter many, many times before I saw it as a two-parter, but I do consider it to be a two-parter, and I think it works better as a two-parter. The sort of parts 1 and 3 cliffhangers, which were written to be cliffhangers, aren't that great. Part 2's a really good cliffhanger, or part 1, if you happen to consider. Yeah, anyway. So this picks up pretty much directly from Destiny of the Daleks. It is a Destiny of the Daleks sequel. It's not just the Daleks and Davros are in this. It follows the events of Destiny of the Daleks. Part of me think that it's a bit of a shame we don't see Mavellans in this at some point. They sort of hang heavily over it and are referenced a few times and are the motivation for the Daleks going to rescue Davros after 50 years or whatever it is. But they'd probably just get massacred, so that'd be another massacre on screen in a story that already has enough. I think this is possibly the best story from a Davros point of view, with, you know, the possible exception of Genesis. I like the fact that Davros sort of gets freed again and goes, okay, well, working with the Daleks just doesn't work for me. I'm going to have to betray them. And he very quickly decides that he's sort of working on his own agenda. And you do have sort of Black Dalek versus Davros behind the scenes manipulation, and it's a nice little B plot, and it's one that you kind of miss because of all the massacres that are going on. It's another story where it feels like the regulars are in genuine danger. Like, this is something I mentioned with Frontios, with TARDIS being destroyed. Like, in this one, the sort of Lytton and his men as these sort of very sinister Dalek agents dressed as police officers, there's something really, really eerie about it. And it sort of played really well. Lytton's a fantastic character. I do think he actually functions better in Attack of the Cybermen than he does this, but that's not to take away from it being a sort of very, very interesting character, very well cast character as well. And he does sort of get away at the end when everyone else is being massacred. Lytton just sort of gets up and walks away and carries on. He's off and in London. And I quite like the fact that there's room for a sequel with him, which we will discuss in a future season by season, obviously. The Daleks, it's not their most effective use, but we do get that feeling of if you meet a Dalek, you are dead, that you did get in sort of the first couple of 60 stories, and then it all kind of fizzed out a little bit, because having Daleks murder everybody they encounter isn't particularly feasible across numerous stories and years. But this feels like Daleks being written very close to how they were in the 60s, and I do like that. So there's lots of things that kind of tie together to make this a pretty good story. Yeah, it's not my favourite, not by a long shot. I like it, don't get me wrong. I'd probably consider it in the top 50% of Doctor Who, but it's nearer 50% than 10%. And I think Sayward himself has said that it does just sort of lack something. I think he was going for, you know, I mean, I always see Eric Sayward as sort of trying to emulate Robert Holmes with pretty much everything he did. He was like a more grim Robert Holmes, but I think if Robert Holmes had done this, he'd have injected a fair bit of humour into it. And when we get to Caves of Androzani, which is a really bloody grim story, we'll probably sort of discuss that as well. There is humour in there. There are sort of moments of twisted humour, perhaps, but humour nonetheless. I just don't think they're pleasant here. This is just a series of very, very unpleasant events. And while it's very atmospheric and while there's lots of great stuff going on, it feels a bit unrelenting. And then at the end of it, you have Tegan, who's one of the longest standing companions in Doctor Who, basically just turns around and goes, you know what, it's too much for me as well. I've had enough. We'll talk Tegan a little bit more when we've been through this story. But meanwhile, I need to hear what you guys think about it. So go first, Greg.
Okay, there's a lot going on here. I do want to correct you. I don't think this is the longest gap between Dalek stories. I think Genesis to Destiny is 5 seasons, is it not?
I think you're right, actually, yes. I can't argue with that.
Well, that's the kind of knowledge my brain is filled with. anyway.
It's still one of the longest gaps.
It's tied for second-ish. I don't know which is exactly long, but regardless. This story has too much going on, I think, is its biggest problem. And because it's so relentlessly dark and relentlessly grim, like, when you have someone yelling, "I can't stand the confusion in my mind," and as a viewer you're like, "Yeah, I get that, I understand," but at the same time, I don't think that it's you need something in there, you know, some kind of humor or something like that to leaven the doom laden atmosphere of it, because if you don't do that, like, it just becomes like a hard watch. And I don't, you know, certainly there are films and even TV shows that have gone this route very successfully, but I don't think Doctor Who is a series that should be punishing its audience, you know. There's too many plots. You know, I love what they do with Davros here. Like, you know, he gets resurrected, hence the title, and he immediately, you know, realizes that the Daleks have grown beyond his control, and so he starts plotting to reassert himself by slowly converting humans and Daleks into his servants. Like, that's great, you know, the interplay between him and the Daleks, that's all fine. What you don't need is the other part where the Daleks are trying to create duplicates of people and also want to assassinate the High Council of the Time Lords, which I'm not sure what that's supposed to accomplish other than just being violent. And then, like, at the end, like, the Supreme Dalek appears on the TARDIS screen, and he's like, "Ah, we still have duplicates in all levels of Earth government." And it's like, oh, that's not good. And then the Doctor's like, "Yeah, they're all going to stop working." Oh, okay, sure. I guess that plot's over then. Like, it that whole thing does not need to be there. The story would work so much better if it was just the Daleks and Davros having their conflict. What else I enjoy about this, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, Eric Sayward is trying to tell a very specific story with season 21. He has a conception of the universe that the universe is a grim, miserable, violent, amoral place, and that a traditional hero like the Doctor is insufficiently equipped to deal with the problems of the universe. This is heavily signposted in Warriors of the Deep. The only plans in that story that the Doctor successfully carries out are the plans that involve killing things. Nothing else he does works. No one listens to him. And he tries to make the Pertwee argument of that, the Silurians can live in peace with the humans, blah, blah, blah. And absolutely no one wants to hear it. Like, that's not even taken remotely seriously. And so at the end, when he says there should have been another way, like, that's not, the hero, making a moral proclamation. That's like, it's an impotent proclamation. It's saying there should have been. Well, there wasn't. So you lose. And, The Awakening and Frontios just ignore this arc entirely. Like, it's not in those stories. But then you get to this one, and it's the same thing. You know, the Doctor doesn't do a whole lot to change the outcome of this story. You know, he has one thing that he very definitively resolves to do, and that's, I'm going to go kill Davros. And then he doesn't do it. He has Davros at gunpoint, and he can't bring himself to pull the trigger. And again, this isn't presented as like a David Tennant, like, heroically putting the gun down and like holding to his principles. This is presented as someone who should do this. He should kill Davros. That would solve everything. But he's just incapable of making himself do it. And it's intended to show him as weak. But and the ironic thing about it is the companions don't know that he didn't kill Davros. Like, I think, and I don't, this is not really explicitly in the text, but I think part of the reason that Tegan leaves is because she thinks the Doctor now is a murderer, and the irony of it is that he wasn't, quote-unquote, strong enough to commit that act. As a character arc in season 21, it works very well. Like, it's one of the best bits of writing that Sayward does. It's just, it's so, ugh. I mean, it doesn't feel like Doctor Who should feel. Like, I as I said before, I don't think that vision of the universe is really compatible with the show. And, you know, the season 21 continues, and we'll talk about this, like, eventually the universe kills this Doctor, and then we're given one who is more capable of engaging with the universe as it really is, which is the Sixth Doctor, except they completely go in a weird direction in Twin Dilemma, and then instead of, like, you know, a dark exploration of the nature of morality, just becomes, like, shock value murders and such in season 22. It never really works, but I admire the ambition of it. I admire that he tried to do something different with the series, and after, you know, it's with this story that you realize that Warriors of the Deep was not a one-off, and you realize that, oh no, they're really going for this here, and this will continue in Planet of Fire and Caves of Androzani. Overall, Resurrection, like I said, it's too overcrowded. It doesn't really work coherently, but it's got a number of brilliant set pieces. It introduces the best Davros actor. You get good performances for Peter Davison and Janet Fielding. Turlough, I mean, he has something to do, but it's still mostly just wandering around the Dalek ship for two episodes or one episode. And to your last point, do I consider this a two-parter or a four-parter? Well, remember, I saw all of these as one-parter omnibus, you know, broadcasts here in the U.S., so I don't really have an opinion on that. It aired as a two-parter, so it's a two-parter.
Yeah, very much my view as well. What it went out as is what it is. Just I think I had the first version of the DVD, which had it as a four-parter, and then I think the second version put it back to a two-parter, if I recall correctly. Go on, Jimmy, talk to us about Resurrection of the Daleks.
Yeah, this one is really interesting. It's very dark, as you both say, but I don't think I liked it quite as much as you guys. I think there's some great stuff, like Tegan's departure at the end was brilliantly handled. Like, there's the whole question of does she know or does she not know that the Doctor didn't actually go through with killing Davros? And when she comes back in after the TARDIS is gone, was she changing her mind and wanting to come back, or was she just wanting to see it off? And I think not knowing the answers works really well there, because it's just such an interesting thing to think about. But overall, I think this is where the problem with Davros sort of really starts to become a big thing. Like, he was great in Genesis. They brought him back for no good reason in Destiny, and it was a bit pointless. And now they've brought him back again, and they literally have one of the Daleks themselves saying, without Davros, we have no future. And it's just like, how far the Daleks have fallen at this stage. Like, you know, we had the whole 60s era where they were brilliant master planners of their own, and now it's just, oh, we're useless without Davros. And it's a bit sad. I mean, it's just a shame that after this point, it took until the new series before we got to see the Daleks without Davros and holding their own again. Also, it's so weird that Davros now has this mind control injection thing he can just use on anyone, Dalek, human, or presumably the robots, the duplicates even. It's just like, okay, if he has that power, why does he even need Daleks at this stage? It's just a bit ridiculous. And also the Daleks, minions and troopers, those weird Dalek helmets. And I can sort of get the, oh yeah, we've given them a sort of Dalek-ish gun. Yeah, that kind of makes sense. But why do they look like they've got a decapitated Dalek on their heads with no eye? I mean, it's got the eye stalk, but with just blank end. It just looks really weird and silly. And also it's pretty dated in some ways. Like, the smoking on this futuristic spaceship is just so weird to see. Like, I mean, I know it's the 80s and that, but like, it just feels weird. And also, the Doctor's confrontation with Davros is so well played between them. That's probably the highlight of the story for me. And it's just comes across as such a letdown when the Doctor leaves the room, because, like, yeah, he wouldn't have been the Doctor anymore. He shouldn't kill anyone. But, like, logically, things would be better without Davros. The Daleks literally said, we're useless without him, and the Doctor lets him live. It's a bit of a, like, I mean, you're torn between wanting the Doctor to be true to himself and wanting him to, you know, do the right thing and not be true to himself. And it's just, yeah, the confrontation there is really well played, and it's just a shame that it doesn't really get resolved. Like, the Doctor just walks out, the door shuts, he can't get back in. Oh, whoops, like, was he leaving on purpose because he couldn't do it, or was it genuinely he just was stupid enough to make the mistake of walking out and not realising Davros would lock him out? It's, yeah, bit of a disappointment, that. And the only other thing I'd really point out is it's so weird when they do the companions and Doctors montage as the Doctor's getting his mind erased, and they just forget about Leela. Like, they remembered Katarina and Sarah, who at this stage were sort of more ambiguous before Big Finish came along or whatever. And like, did they count as a companion or not? And yet they both get in and Leela doesn't. Like, how does that happen? Like, I mean, especially you hear about the 80s and, you know, oh, Intervene, I made sure they did continuity, but they forgot Leela existed. What the hell? But yeah, I mean, despite all the faults, it is a good story, but yeah, it's definitely, it had a lot more potential than it actually lived up to, I reckon, personally.
See, I reckon this now throws Leela's status as a companion into ambiguity. Maybe she never was. Like, or mate, Time War. There we go. It was Time War. That's what did it. There we go. Fixed it. Maybe. Okay, so that's the stories we're going to discuss in today's episode. And three of them have been fantastic. One of them has been Warriors of the Deep. Very quickly before we go, we've just got a few minutes to talk about, I guess, Tegan and Tegan's departure, because I think on paper, this, as we've discussed, this one's handled quite well. Like, you know, she does sort of leave with her view of the Doctor shattered, and there is that bit where she comes back in as well, and, you know, oh, is she coming back to say, no, I've changed my mind, I'm wrong, or she's just seeing the tardy self. This is Tegan, who's been through so much, though, and she has left and she has come back before, and she's been with the Doctor for, you know, quite a long time. And you do just sort of think, could they have spent a little bit more time saying goodbye to her? Could there have been more of a discussion or a debate or that kind of thing? Because it does seem to be very abrupt. It is just like, I'm not coming, it stopped being fun, bye. And yeah, I, while I like it, while it's effective, and while there's plenty of subtext there, I just feel as though it could have been realised a little bit better. It just feels like another abrupt ending, of which we've had quite a few. You know, we've sort of said Snake Dance kind of just stops, Warriors of the Deep kind of just stops. This one doesn't so much do that, because it does have to get rid of a companion. It does have to see Tegan off. But yeah, part of me just sort of thinks, could they have made another 5 minutes for it? You know, something along the lines of the Hand of Fear or whatever. I don't know, because there's so much going on in this story. It's all rushed at the end, not just the Tegan part. So anything you guys want to add about Tegan and her departure? Greg, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of an episode count, I'm sure she's nowhere near the top, but in terms of, like, just calendar time spent as a companion, I mean, Tegan's right up there with Sarah Jane as one of the longest-running companions the show ever had. And so I think what really made her work was her relationship with Peter Davison and the way that they were able to put this, like, combative relationship between the two characters on screen. Like, this doctor is generally very patient and kind to his other companions, even, you know, the one, except when Adric really pisses him off, but even the one that tried to kill him, he's, you know, patient with. But Tegan, he never is. He's just a jerk to her half the time. But she gives it right back. And, you know, it's one of the best doctor-companion relationships the show ever has, because Tegan is not scared of him. She's not intimidated by him. She's more than happy to give as good as she gets. And the Doctor is frustrated by her stubbornness, but he also admires her for it. And yeah, I mean, she's a great character. And when you watch, you know, the DVD special features, or you see conventions or whatever, you see that the two actors have a very similar relationship even now. And it's just a lot of fun to watch them be together. So yeah, I mean, I know there are people who don't care for Tegan. I know there are people who say that she's, like, whiny and annoying, and, like, I honestly, like, it was something I was watching out for in this rewatch, and I didn't see that. I mean, yeah, there's a couple times early on when she's like, for God's sake, get me back home, but, like, she drops that, and she very explicitly does so on screen. And from then on, she's, you know, she's just a normal companion. Her departure is great. It's, again, it's in line with what Sayward's trying to do with this season. And she spends this entire story just being repeatedly traumatized, whether she's physically hurt and struck in the head, or whether she's watching people die, watching the policeman, you know, just murder a guy off in the distance for practically no reason. And then, like I said, at the end, I think, like, to think that the Doctor did go and kill Davros, like he said he was going to, it's very clear why she would get disillusioned by this story. I think most people would get disillusioned by this experience. That wasn't fun. That wasn't an adventure. That was just an unending parade of misery. And yeah, I mean, I can see why Turlough puts up with it, because he's Turlough. But Tegan, yeah, no, I, I, I am not surprised at all that she quit at this point. And yeah, I mean, it's a sad way for the character's, you know, journey in the TARDIS to end. It's not really fitting with so much of the rest of her tenure, but it works. And again, it's all part of what they're trying to do with this season. And yeah, I think it's successful.
And what about you, Jimmy?
Yeah, I think I've come to like Tegan as a character a lot more through this latest rewatch. I previously found her to be a bit annoying in the past, and I think part of that is the sort of like the clearly exaggerated accent. Like, she's Australian, but she's playing it up because JNT wants the Australian companion, and she just sort of irritated me a bit with it in the past. But seeing all her stories in order again, it definitely, she puts more work into the character than I'd sort of remembered. She does a really good job with it. I think, yes, she is a bit annoying in season 19 when every 2 minutes it's take me home, take me home, take me home. But once she comes back in season 20, that aspect's gone, and she's no longer stuck in the same stewardess costume all the time. She actually gets a bit more to do. And then, of course, this season comes along and she gets all that darker stuff that leads to her getting that brilliant, perfectly handled departure. So, yeah, I've come to appreciate Tegan a lot more on this latest review. She's never going to be one of my, like, top 10 or whatever companions, but I like her more than I did before we had this latest rewatch. So I'm glad that I can appreciate her more now as a character.
Yeah, she's a character who's certainly gone up in my estimations sort of over recent years as well. Like, there's far more to her than the sort of whiny, grumpy all the time stereotype. Absolutely. So that's all we've got time for today. Then we'll come back and we'll discuss the remainder of the season, which also, you know, comes with Turlough's departure and the Fifth Doctor's departure. So we've got plenty to talk about in regards to season 21 still. And, you know, obviously, to bring our Spodcast listeners back, we're making them wait for Androzani. Ooh. But it's worth the wait. We love Caves of Androzani. Everybody should. So that's it. We will leave it there. So I will say thank you and goodbye to Greg.
Thank you and goodbye. See you next time.
And thank you and goodbye to Jimmy.
Thanks. Wait, so next time we have to do the twin dilemma, there should have been another way.
Well played.
Very, very well played. Yeah. I've just like geared people up for it with the promise of Caves of Androzani, and you've just like completely ruined all my hard work. never mind. We'll be back next. Maybe people are more interested in us talking about Twin Dilemma than they are as just heaping praise on Caves. Perhaps that's it. Maybe you've done the right thing. So yes. Regardless of what it is you prefer, heaping praise on Caves or not heaping praise on Twin Dilemma, we'll be back for more Spodcasting soon.
Left out right now.
We'll be back to talk about more Doctor Who soon. Goodbye now.